Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the TF Podcast, where we discuss technology and finance, and that typically revolves around Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency. I'm excited for my next guest. His name is John Wu, and he is the founder and president of Ava Labs. With that, John, I'd love if you could introduce yourself to everybody.
Hey, Jonathan. Thank you for having me today. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, excellent.
So as Jonathan said, I am the president of Ava Labs, not a founder, but I am the president of Ava Labs. Ava Labs is a group of really exceptional distributed systems and network developers and scientists. Maybe a little bit helpful for your audience if I talk a little bit about my background, my path to Ava, and what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, definitely. It'd be great to just learn a little bit about yourself. Like, just how did you get involved in the finance space to begin with?
Cool. So going back, that means we're going way back when. So I started my career in the traditional financial services world as an investor. I was an investor at various hedge funds in many different types of products, but primarily a tech investor. Tiger Management was my first place. And then I ran a tech portfolio at Kingdon Capital. Ultimately, I ran my own fund that was seeded by the Blackstone Group. And I got into Bitcoin, crypto, circa 2014 and 2015. Now, I thought it was a great investment, but what was just as impressive to me was how inefficient those markets today and even more so back then were. I mean, it literally kind of reminded me of like financial markets in the 90s or 2000s, yeah. In the sense of being able to find good investments and find things that other people don't know.
Yeah. And when you're saying that, are you meaning to just like the way like the trading aspects work of it from like the technology side or even just the whole entire construct?
So everything part. Yeah. So I would break that down as efficiencies in the markets, the amount, breadth of available product or instruments, the tools you use to try to trade and to capture your portfolio and the risk associated with that. The underlying infrastructure of the exchanges and the different geographies of how things traded. The same Bitcoin would trade at different prices and different premiums, depending on where, what part of the country you were. And then the regulations. So very unclear, especially in 14, 15. I mean, you know, again, like I think if I look back at traditional financial services and using those five categories as barometers as to where crypto is today, it's either in the 90s or somewhere in 1920s before the Securities Act of 1933-34 reform.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So you spent some time in that. Were you doing investment banking? Is that right?
No, I was a proprietary principal investor on the hedge fund side.
Got it. Yeah. And what type of investments are you making on the hedge fund side? What was your look?
So throughout my career, I've done various products, but mostly I've been a tech investor. And if we were to draw some parallels in the early days of investing in the 90s for me and seeing what's happening now in crypto, it's pretty interesting because there was a lot of arbitrage available back in the 90s due to different geographies. I'll give you an example. In the 90s, everyone wanted to get access to the double-digit GDP growing countries like the Southeast Asian countries or the East Asian countries like Korea or Taiwan. But it was not easy to get access to those shares or those indices. I mean, basically, if you were a local, there was an onshore market for you. If you were a foreigner, you had allocations in what they call the offshore shares. So there's like an A share and a B share. And then if you were a retail individual, you had to buy these funds. They're called either the Taiwan fund or the Korea fund. So what was fascinating was that if you were an institution, you were able to get access to the offshore stuff, you would pay a 30% premium to your local brethren. And if you were a retail person and you want access to Korea, you would literally pay 100% premium to get access to that Korea fund so you can get access to a fast growing market and the securities of that country. Now, if you were a sophisticated institution, what you did was you created complex derivatives. And in those derivatives, you can actually create, you know, swaps or swaptions with a local brokerage firm, and they would charge you an extra 5%. So instead of paying 30% like every other institution trying to get access to these markets, you only paid an extra 5%, almost the same price as the local guys. And if you think about crypto today, that dynamic still actually exists today. I mean, especially in 2014 and 15. So the access to buying crypto, whether it's BTC or whether it's Ethereum, it's not that easy for the average person. I mean, Jonathan, you and I are different. We've been, you know, involved in these markets for a long time. We're very comfortable getting our own ledgers, you know, setting up a wallet or going to the exchanges and buying for ourselves. So we're almost like the equivalent of that local guy getting the underlying security at par.
Yeah.
But then even if you're like a sophisticated investor and you don't have time or don't want to manage it, there are these, you know, basically open-end funds or trusts that are set up where you can put your money in, and there is a lockup period about a year where you can't trade that thing. But after a year, that instrument actually has a fungible product in the OTC market where you can actually sell what you bought. And that OTC product is actually trading at a significant premium. I think the latest I saw in ETH was like a 400% premium.
Got it.
Bitcoin used to be at 100% premium. That premium has now shrunk to 10%. Because just like the traditional world with the Korea fund and the Taiwan fund, ultimately that arbitrage gets shrunk away. But this is what I mean by, if you look at stuff in the crypto markets today, it reminds me of the way markets traded at a very 20, 30 years ago in the traditional market.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, what do you think needs to happen to, or maybe not what needs to happen, but what are the opportunities here, right? When we think about how those aspects can be improved, and because the legacy financial system isn't necessarily the North Star, right? Like there's built on old rails and old behaviors and so forth. What are your kind of thoughts on the opportunities here for how that evolves?
So ultimately it takes time for anything to change. I'm gonna evoke my history here of financial services, but Jack Bogle from Vanguard, the legendary investor, he actually created passive index type mutual fund products back in the 1970s. And I think people laughed at him. They were just like, why would anyone want to do this? And if you're in that industry, you're kind of right. Like, Jack, why are you making it more efficient so we can't extract our big pie from the markets?
Yeah. But then why are you going to make it so we don't get as much value as we used to?
Well, I mean, then, you know, that was the core and the concept that led to the SPY or the S&P futures that didn't come till I think 1993 or 94. And there was only like three or four of those back in the 90s. I think it was the SPY, the GLD, which is gold, and maybe a few others. But now fast forward 15, 20 years, and it's like, wow, there's a gazillion ETFs. You can't even count how many ETFs there are. So I think the answer is it's going to take time. It's going to take creative guys like Jack Bogle was in the 1970s. And a lot of those creative guys right now and the big dreamers, sure, they are in the crypto world. But what they need to do is take that creativity and marry it to someone from a traditional financial services background who understands regulation, compliance, structuring a product, and a deep knowledge of a market structure to help create products and also tools as well as infrastructure that allows not only the crypto market to be more efficient so that you don't have these 90 to 100% premiums for the average investor, but also to allow traditional financial services to access a whole new group of, you know, potential investors and entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Yeah. My point of view on it is that the traditional legacy system needs to innovate forward. And I would argue that the crypto system needs to innovate backwards in the sense of like, you know, integrating into or offering some of these services that traditional banks offer. Like one of the things I've said for a long time is you know, you think about the market cap of just crypto in general, you know, market cap of Bitcoin, I think right now is probably like about 180 billion, 175 billion, somewhere in that range. And like all of crypto is, you know, what, like maybe like 300 or maybe
not
might
even.
Be even less.
Not even.
I would say it's probably less than that. Probably like more like 250 even. So, for me, like if I'm a product person or if I'm someone at Coinbase or one of these companies, for one of the first logical things would be like, let's offer some of these traditional financial services, you know, even just like easy way to purchase some stocks or things like that, just to get those people into, I would think of that as a lead source, right? So it's interesting how, when you think about even on both sides, it's like, hey, we're used to the way that we operate, and sometimes we don't want to shift that, but there is significant opportunity on both ends of it. I'm curious kind of what your thoughts are.
Jonathan. I think there are two big themes in what you just talked about. First is that, you know, given that we are in an industry that has a market cap of literally about 280 billion, and most of that is Bitcoin, if you just compare that to the US equity markets of $30 trillion, yeah. And the US equity markets is actually the smallest of those markets, that gives you some idea of where this asset class can potentially go. So I think that was the first thing you brought up.
Yeah.
And the second part of what you were asking about was, how do we bring those products that exist, the plethora of products that exist in the financial services market, over to the crypto world? And we're seeing that with the DeFi boom right now. DeFi is probably the fastest growing sector inside of crypto. And this is where Ava comes in, actually. You know, Ava was founded by Eamon Gunseer, the Cornell professor. He had this vision. It was not just to be a first layer protocol, although that engine that we have is incredible, but he built it with purpose. And the purpose was to ultimately create features and applications that enable others to build financial products, to tokenize assets, to digitize assets, and to even create their own marketplaces so that someone can create an asset and transact that asset, and others can come into the ecosystem and build products. Mm-hmm. So our dream, well, you know, our goal would be great if we build this great engine and we have all these features and tools, and then a great creative crypto dev is coupled with a forward-looking financial services experience old hat, if you will, who understands product, understands regulation, understands governance, and the two of them coming together and creating a viable regulatory compliant product in the crypto world. I mean, this is how the crypto markets need to evolve to become more efficient. At the same time, it can help traditional financial services have commercial applications right away so they can start adopting the newest and latest technology.
Yeah. One of the things I think is super interesting about the DeFi as well is sort of what you alluded to in the beginning of the conversation with some of the inefficiencies, and then, you know, the example that you gave with Vanguard, like making more essentially of the margin available to the consumer. And that's really what DeFi has been able to do. You know, a lot of these DeFi products are giving anywhere from like 5 to 8, as high as like 10% back on people's money. And one of their value props, at least what from a marketing perspective that some of these DeFi companies are saying, is like, hey, we're just giving up more margin, you know, to the consumer. Curious what your thoughts are on that, especially too, because while I appreciate that and I think it's a novel way to think, what we've seen in every single industry is margin shrink as you gain market share, right? You know, purchasing things online used to be significantly more, significantly cheaper to kind of incentivize you to do so. And now it's the same price. And the reason why you purchase online is because it's convenient, right? It's like, I might spend more on something for Amazon than I would elsewhere, even if they have traditionally better prices, just because it's so convenient, I just push a button type of thing. What are your thoughts overall and just how DeFi is being portrayed in that regard? And then, are they going to shrink down eventually one day as well?
Well, I'll answer your second question first.
Yeah.
Will they shrink down? Absolutely. I mean, whether it's crypto or traditional finance or e-commerce business model or advertising model, we're all subject to the same rules of economics. Abnormal economic profits will invite new entrants into that marketplace and they will compete that down.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of that lending product that you're talking about in DeFi, where they're offering 5, 10, even higher, you know, they need that. They are giving away some of the margin, but they need that. I mean, for two reasons. From a business perspective, it's their customer acquisition costs.
Sure.
You need to entice people to come in. And we've seen this play out in other types of businesses in Silicon Valley where they're willing to spend money, lose money in order to aggregate customers. So that's one thing. But the second thing I think people overlook here is it's also a reflection of how inefficient the market is. You talked about how margins come down. That's a great barometer for how mature and how competitive an industry is. If you look at going back to Jack Bogle, his mission in life was to give low cost products to retail investors. And he has now effectively started this movement, and Vanguard has become a behemoth, but started this movement where ETFs, you know, are literally cost you basis points. In fact, there's a new ETF I just saw that actually for the first 100 billion in assets or something, they will actually pay you to use this ETF. So, for me, do I want to go into industry where they're paying you on the tail end of the industry in order to adopt the product? Or do you want to go into a place where there's still 10% lending when treasuries are at under 1%? That's just an indication of how much potential this industry has.
Yeah.
That will shrink, and it will shrink relatively fast. Just like we started this call with how, you know, retail investors, the only way they can get access to Korean stocks in the 90s was through these Korea funds or you know, regional funds that charged 100% premium. Today, you know, it's zero. It's basically you can buy the same share that a local guy pays for.
You're right. Right. Now, you know, now there are some concerns about the security in DeFi products, right? From I don't want to say a regulatory standpoint, but more from an insurance standpoint, right? Being FDIC insured. And if you read the language of some of these DeFi products, they're purposely vague, just like any product, by the way. It's not just them, like all products, T's and C's and privacy agreements are incredibly vague. So, you know, some people have concern of like, hey, if I put my money in these DeFi products, you know, and the company goes under or they get hacked, you know, is my information, or sorry, not my information, is my crypto secure? What do you know about that? Is there, are we in the right place yet with that? Is there still some?
Well, we're not even close to, the right place. There's a lot in what you just talked about. So, I mean, tying this with the previous question, they better be paying you at least 10% for you to even look at these products, okay? Mm-hmm. To loan them your collateral, because I mean, you're taking credit risk and counterparty risk that you do not have or to any significant extent in the traditional financial services. That's why you get almost nothing at your bank, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, whatever it is, and where you can get all of this great double-digit yielding the lending products here. That's because you're taking a lot more risk. You're not just taking risk on your money, you're taking risk of the counterparty. And a lot of these are just pure raw startups. So
sure, yeah.
I may not even, you know, want to, you know, take that product out at 10%. I mean, you better pay me some more for me to put my money there so you can, you know, lend it out to other people. That's the first thing. The second thing is, this is exactly, I think, what Ava is trying to address. There's a security issue. And Ava, and I can't talk about in specifics right now, we're about to go on the mainnet and we built some features and products that are, I would say, revolutionary in terms of security for this crypto market. And it's going to be aimed towards DeFi players. When the DeFi players want to build on top of Ava and see not only the scale and the speed with which they can do things and ease, but also the security that we're going to offer, not only through our consensus protocol, but also through the products that we're building on top of our protocol, it'll be incredible. In fact, to close out on the security issue, I don't know if you guys read the whole thing with Goldman Sachs yesterday. Everyone was anticipating they were going to come out and say,
yeah, it's definitely something I wanted to talk about with you.
well, the thing in there, and you know, I don't much ascribe to their recommendations. I'm not saying they're bad or good. It's just, I'm a professional investor, but I've always wanted my own opinion on these things. And I just like to look at the facts and make my decision. But the thing that stood out the most for me in that thing was that Goldman Sachs claims that crypto was not an asset class. I don't know if you read that.
I saw that. Yeah.
And yeah, we can't actually read minds.
We wrote an article about it today on our blog. But yeah, it's especially considering major players consider it an asset class. So government.
Well, I mean, you know,
the IRS considers it an asset class, right? So
I think Goldman is smart to say that. They're kind of covering their ass. I mean, if they start transacting this thing, and if it is an asset class, they are subject to certain rules that they have to abide by. I mean, when I ran my fund for my investors, I made the decision back in 14, 15 that if I was going to get into crypto, I would do it for myself. I was not going to put it in the fund. There's all sorts of reasons why. But the biggest reason was, if I had lost some money and some security for my investors, I can say, hey, this is unrealized. It's a mark-to-market loss. I still believe in this. It's going to come back. And that's fully acceptable. Goldman cannot tell their clients that, by the way, this crypto stuff that we were working on with you, it got hacked and it kind of just like disappeared. So you just lost the money. I can get it back to you. That's not forgivable. If they lose you money by recommending bad investments or if their proprietary desks lose money, that's understandable. That's a risk that investors, institutions, or individuals have understood and they're willing to take. But you cannot tell an individual or an institution that some other institution completely lost your money because of a hack. I don't know if you read the Wall Street Journal report. I think it was about a week ago, where they cited that roughly $2 billion have been hacked in crypto exchanges.
I had not seen that, but I believe it.
So they went around and collected some data. They don't even know if the number is right, and no one really knows, but you know, they did a best estimate, and that directionally they're correct. There have been billions lost in hacks throughout massive attempts by cyber theft. At exchanges, and it's questionable whether the exchanges themselves have had exit scams of their own.
Right. So, yeah, have they participated in any of it? Totally.
So this all ties back into your security question. I mean, and it all goes back to our first question, is how mature is the space? It's not mature yet. These things have to be fixed. And once you see these things fixed, you're going to see that 250, 280 billion of market cap explode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. One thing I like to say, and the way I think, is that, whether humans as individuals or companies are all motivated by incentives, right? And, you think of that can be good and bad incentives. And so like some of those things that you're talking about are significant risks for a company or an institution that has traditionally been very conservative, right? And so, I totally agree with that point. For Goldman Sachs to get involved with cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, what that means is that they need to get experts in the field to either build out the systems for themselves internally, which is a significant cost, or they need to partner with an external, cryptocurrency exchange of sorts, which is also going to be a significant cost, because that exchange is going to want a significant amount of margin. So again, when you I like to be really rational into why people, or in my assumptions at least, into why people make decisions. So if you're Goldman Sachs, do you want to say like, hey client, buy some Bitcoin and we're going to essentially give up 50% of the margin that we would get, or buy traditional financial services and we'll get the majority of that margin because that's where we play? And so that's kind of just my outlook. Is if I'm them, that's probably how I would be thinking about it. But I'd be really surprised if they don't have an internal working group that has a separate point of view than what was articulated,
Because they absolutely do. All of the banks do. They have innovation labs and they have other people in there working. They know that there is potential here. Sure. And they cannot just completely turn a blind eye. But publicly, they need to say what they need to say.
Totally.
Listen, I mean, in the ICO craze, you know, $8 billion, $9 billion was raised. You know, equivalent to an IPO, that's like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that fees were not collected on by these big banks. So when the numbers get that big, people are going to pay attention. You're going to have these innovation labs inside of the big organizations. Now, but they are basically more research labs than they are innovation labs.
Totally.
They're there just to keep a pulse on things so that when things are commercialable, they pounce on it.
Right.
Because they have knowledge. It's your classic bank, you know, they bring a smart entrepreneur in and they basically suck their brain dry until they can understand everything and they do nothing with it. And then when it is time, they're able to jump right in on it. I mean, they need this. I mean, a lot of their margins now, we talked about ETFs paying people to invest. A lot of their margins are going zero. I mean, in the crypto world, you know, custody has been this big issue, right? You know, in 2017, when everyone said, why is crypto going to go up forever? And part of it was one argument besides applications on the technology side. On the investment side, it was about how this wave of institutional people are going to come in.
Yeah.
But in order to solve that, you need to solve the custody issue.
Yeah.
But people forget custody in traditional financial services is a low, low, low margin business.
Totally.
And you don't make money custody. Custody is like big at the table. It's table stakes. You know, you make money off of other things you do in that platform. And that's part of the reason why even in crypto,
a lot of it's trading, right? A lot of the
trading, taking your money, pooling it and lending it to others.
Sure, lending as well. Yeah.
All that stuff. But this is, you know, and providing value added services.
Right.
This is why I think Coinbase even, you know, I think this week or last week they bought Tagomi.
Yeah.
That purchase, you know, even Coinbase realizes, listen, you know, in the long run, even in crypto, custody is not going to be the competitive edge. And that's a place where margins are going to go to zero. They're already thinking now of tomorrow, what products they need, and what they need to add value in order to keep their margins high.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're definitely uniquely positioned to, you know, really to become a bank, to become a full on, you know, even traditional bank, to what the point I was saying a little bit ago is, you know, offering some traditional financial services, you know, for that overall adoption. But even within just the space, there's obviously enough opportunity there from a revenue standpoint for them to continue to grow at the capacity that they have been able to. You know, for those of us in the space, obviously we get excited and, you know, I obviously believe in the long-term value of Bitcoin, which is the main reason, you know, I'm interested in it. And, but it's easy to forget or not realize that, you know, look, going back to the market cap, Bitcoin is like I said, about 180 billion market cap. It's Goldman Sachs, because I was looking at this yesterday, is I think it's 72 million dollar or sorry billion dollar market cap. But then you think of a company like Visa, which is a $400 billion market cap, and then like what you were talking a moment ago, the equities being what did you say, $30 trillion market cap,
37 trillion,
and it's and it's a smaller. So like, yes, you know, again, when you're thinking about it from a financial standpoint, as to I'm not saying I agree with their decision, but it's like, man, if this is 150, we got to put all this infrastructure into it to make it so that we can do it and we could just, you know, get people going on what we already know, like, let's keep them there in that lane. That, you know, that's probably how Goldman is thinking in that regard. But as we all know, those who don't innovate end up getting left behind in time overall. So it'll definitely be interesting to see when that flip switches for Goldman and for other companies. Because I do believe one last point. I do believe that in time, the majority of consumers' interaction with Bitcoin will be through traditional banking. And that will mean, whether that means Coinbase and those type of companies become traditional banks, or traditional banks begin to offer these services via partnerships with crypto companies, or, you know, they start doing it themselves. Because you know, my mother, for example, I've said this multiple times on my show, my mom asked me to manage her iPhotos because this is easier for her. She needs some level of custody. She doesn't feel comfortable buying Bitcoin and storing it, regardless if it's on Cash App or whatever easy mechanism it is. So.
Well, I mean, until the day where the margins from that crypto DeFi startup come down to the point where you have a choice between putting your money at a, I don't know, call it Bank of America, and you earn 1%, and that, you know, crypto entrepreneur DeFi company is only giving you 3%. That margin reflects the potential for more entrepreneurs in the DeFi space.
Sure.
I'll give one company a lot of credit in the traditional space, and I'm not saying the others don't deserve it. I think they all have seen how technology in California has disrupted a lot of industries. So they're very much aware. In fact, I think they're very smart. A lot of them are creating these innovation research hubs. They are incubating ideas, incubating technology. So they are ready for it to commercialize when the inflection point happens. But right now, I mean, the guys at BACT, I think, are pretty interesting because, you know, the CME futures for Bitcoin, if you look at that, you know, those are all cash settled, I believe. You know, BACT is trying to do a physical settled ETH futures strip. That is not easy. And obviously, when there's physical settlement, there's a lot of security risks. So for BACT to want to take that chance, and keep in mind, ICE is a behemoth in this market. So it's not like, you know, the fourth or fifth entrant in that market trying to survive creating new products. ICE is, you know, ICE and CME, they are the big boys. For them to have this whole innovation engine behind and try to spur development, and take the risk and trying to create physical settlement, that is ultimately what you need for the repo market. Because like when you have a futures contract, you know, the arbitrageurs come in immediately. They need the repo market in order to sell futures buy spot. And that's what creates the liquidity. And then from there, you have options and derivatives, and then you have depth in market to the point where the derivatives markets in the equities world, I think it's five times or more of that than the $37 trillion underlying that we talked about. You need deep spot markets, and then you need deep futures and options markets to create even more complex stuff. Take this back into the DeFi world. All the derivative stuff that we see, they're not economically true derivative products. They're more like prediction market betting things because they don't have the economic soundness of a traditional market because it's not deep enough for people to come in and hedge and create that liquidity properly. And the second thing is, you know, a lot of them, what they're doing is actually probably not compliant in terms of regulation. The CFTC will probably not go for some of these products. This is, again, what, you know, Ava tries to address. We embed governance into our features and applications. And again, we're enablers. We want people in the traditional world who have that knowledge to come and work with someone who's going to develop stuff and put them together and then create a product that's better for both worlds.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense. So let's dig into that real quick, just on the Ava side. So we've discussed it slightly throughout, but what really is Ava about? And you know, what's kind of on the horizon for Ava?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the long-term vision we have is that you can transfer value of an asset as easily as you can send an email. Now, granted, even regular securities, you can't do it that easily, but you know, put that down as the vision, as the starting point, and work backwards. So Ava is a powerful consensus protocol. We're backed by Andreessen Horowitz, Initialize, Polychain, and Metastable. Eamon Gunseer took it out of Cornell University, commercialized it, and we are about to go on the mainnet. And again, like I think I talked about it already, this engine, we are building features and applications on top of it. And we're targeting that and designing the architecture all for financial services. In other words, you know, we've built in ease of use so that traditional financial services firms who want to spin up their own private blockchain or want to digitize an asset, they can do it relatively easily, almost like Wix, drag and click and create your own website. Compared to that 10 years ago, I had to hire HTML coders to come into your office. And the second thing is, when you issue an asset or when you create a marketplace, you need a certain level of governance. And sure, there is the hard-coded stuff that can be on the smart contract, like, you know, KYC, AML, but each security, each instrument, each organization has their own standards of how secure, how they want to govern and how much control they need in this market. So we've provided a way that in a sub-network manner where you can create your own marketplace and you can choose your own validators and choose your own rules for governance. So if you are a big bank and you care about the life cycle of that asset, not only can you program stuff at the smart contract layer, but you have control over the validators. And if your standards change over time, you can affect that change at the validator, the node level, so you have more flexibility.
Excellent. Super interesting. In the commoditizing of technology through, you know, these types of things is what essentially opens it up to more entrance, right? Is when you start thinking about that, how the Wix is like one of the best examples, right? I use Wix all the time. One of the main reasons I use Wix is because I need other people to be able to collaborate on there that have no concept of HTML or code, and it just makes it super easy that way. So, you know, I can imagine there's some parity and continued similarities, you know, with what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I drive a car. I have no idea how to put it together or how the engine works, but I can go from 0 to 100 as fast as anyone else can. Right. And that's kind of what we want to make blockchain creation, you know, private blockchains and also asset digitization to be. Yeah. It just becomes part of your routine. In fact, I think, you know, similar to AWS, you know, one day we're not even going to be talking about AWS. It just, everything just resides up there. Some point blockchains, people are not going to be talking about, you know, how this works. It's just part of whatever they're totally doing. And when that happens, it'll be a very exciting day.
I totally agree with you on that. You know, my point of view when it comes to that is thinking about how, as a technologist, your job is to satisfy requirements, right? Like you have a level of requirements of what you're trying to achieve and, you know, for your use case or for your customer set, et cetera. And you're always going to take the elements of the best technology and essentially bring it all together to fit your need overall. So, you know, really that's what it comes down to. And then like, yeah, how do you productize, package that, make it even more accessible? And that's what essentially innovation is. And so, you know, sometimes you'll have people that'll be like, oh, well, you know, that private blockchain is not decentralized, or it's not, you know, it's a centralized system. And my response to always that is that, so what if it is or it isn't, because that is meant to satisfy the requirements of the business, right? And how the business operates. And so whether or not they gain consumers will also be based off of that, but then also the social construct that they create. And so then to compare that to Bitcoin, for example, that's frankly one of the reasons I'm very bullish about Bitcoin, is the fact that the social construct is, you know, kind of outside of its even ecosystem, and the fact that it does have, from a technology standpoint and a growth standpoint, very much these highly decentralized aspects. So I don't think it needs to be one or the other, or products for companies need to be built in the image of Bitcoin. I think they can have separate lanes, and that's what makes it interesting. Where I find that a lot of the tension usually arises is when, you know, in the ICO boom, we had a lot of these companies that basically were saying that they were going to supplant Bitcoin, or that they were super decentralized. And in fact, they had very much high incentives of the ones creating it, right? And so like, that's where the tension is. But as far as using the best technology for the job at hand, you know, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah, why wouldn't you? I mean, yeah. I think our take on that, at least at Ava, is that private blockchains are a necessity for certain enterprises right now. They do provide cost savings. And if it's a better database than a SQL server, why not use that? If they have their own internal smaller network and it's efficient for them, let's let them have that. That's why we have this hybrid system where they can spin up their own private blockchain. But if they ever want to make it permissionless and connect to the other private blockchains and everyone opens up on Ava, then they have a permissionless system.
Sure.
But people need to adopt for a reason. And if the first reason is because I can take 200 basis points out of my costs in a private blockchain, that's fantastic. What I was trying to do is give them an easy door to open so if they ever want to enter the permissionless world, they can.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. You know, so real quick before we wrap up, you've been in finance and in the tech world for a long time. What are your thoughts of just what's happening in the world? we've changed and we've shifted to this work from home. Even though the markets are doing well, they seem to be inflated, based off of the circumstances. Just curious kind of your overall insight into 2020 into the end of May 2020, halfway through this movie that we call 2020.
So I think most of that question in terms of what will happen is what are my thoughts on the markets and how that relates to crypto. So, you've talked about how you're very bullish on Bitcoin and a lot of luminaries in traditional financial space, actually, most recently, Paul Tudor Jones. He's someone that wouldn't ever touch this about 4 years ago. And now he's out there talking about it. So I think if you look at it first from a US centric perspective, you've seen the Fed's balance sheet shrink from $5 trillion after the peak in 2014-ish or 15 down to about $4 trillion. And all of a sudden this happens in the span of like 6 weeks, it's back to $7 trillion. Mm-hmm. And the talk is that it's gonna get even bigger. And then you look at where that money is, and it's not one-to-one, but it's not perfect. But money supply numbers, cash, marketable securities, cash equivalents in the US has spiked by roughly the same amount. So that means that money is still kind of on the sidelines and needs to be deployed into stuff. What stuff? Will it be used for buying refrigerators, cars, or will it be put into markets? I think when you have printed so much money, you've shifted the or tweaked the supply and demand. I mean, a lot of things who are fixed supply, whether it be gold or Bitcoin, and there's more of the other thing, which is the dollar. At some point, I would say that those assets would have to inflation. I'm not saying there will be inflation in the whole economy, but there will be asset inflation for those fixed supply assets and fiat deflation. That's a US-centric view. If I were in Latin America right now, and I've seen my currency since the crisis happened, tail off, Brazilian real, I think, is down 30-40%. Argentina, Venezuela, all of these local currencies are down 30-40%. I mean, it's no wonder that the crypto activity, whether it be on the exchanges and wallets or remittances, have spiked incredibly. Sure. So from that perspective, the reality of blockchain, crypto, or Bitcoin being a store of value for them, that is very real already. Whether in the US that plays itself out, it's still to be determined, but there's no doubt that the chances of Bitcoin becoming a better store of value, at least from a perception perspective, has increased tremendously.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Well, John, the final question I like to ask everybody that comes on my show is, what is a question that you have that you would like to ask our audience? Something that they can think about or discuss amongst their colleagues and friends as they go about their day.
What is the one product in crypto that they need and want that they don't have right now?
Nice. All right. What is that? What's that one product you need? Love it. John, what are some good ways that people can stay in touch with you, follow you, see what you're up to?
Absolutely. So you can go to our website, avalabs.org. And my Twitter handle is John1WU.
Perfect. Awesome. Thanks so much, John. Thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Jonathan, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah. Everyone, thank you for listening to another episode of the TF Podcast. Please make sure that you are liked and subscribed wherever you're listening to this. Do us a favor and fill in those stars, as that goes a long way to getting our podcast in front of more folks so we can continue to do great shows like this one. You can follow me at JGProduct on Twitter, as well as at TF Labs Media. Thanks so much. And also make sure to check out our site, tflabs.io. We'll talk to you soon.